It doesn't matter how many times you go to Shipwreck SF, it still shocks you when Seinfeld hits on a Dickens character. Yeah. Which I mean, and I mean this, I'm putting that in the marketing. Come see me and you'll get a Dickens pin. Okay, I mean a butt stuff pin, not a Dickens pin. I don't have Dickens pins.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to Tale of Two Cuties. I'm Casey.
Tale of Two Cuties. I can't believe autocorrect just owned me on my own marketing copy. Like, how the fuck?
I love it.
I literally typed in Tale of Two Cities and my phone was like, nope, cuties. I did read this. Did you read this one? Or did you
the
listen
book?
To it?
I did. Yeah. I believe I... You know what? I didn't finish it.
Yeah. It's a lot. It's good, but it's a lot.
I only got to where... Like, I was like, oh, this is all going to end badly. I started feeling
that. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's Dickens.
And I had already done the other one.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't need to do two of these in 1 year.
Which other one?
The French one.
Les Mis.
Yeah.
But that was a whole year earlier.
Yeah, but it...
I mean, it was.
I'm not a good man.
You're right, it does end badly, but it's Dickens, so everything ends badly.
As it was setting up, I was like, you forget how much energy Joe gave in Great Expectations that's missing from this book, where there's not like one like sad sack to point at and be like, oh, at least he's having a good time.
True. Hey, who Sabine? Got first? Yeah.
Wait, that's a character,
Jarvis
right?
Jarvis Lorry.
Isn't Satine a character?
No.
Santine?
That's Lemus. Santine? Satine? No, that's a fabric. You're thinking of a fabric. I think you're thinking of Fantine, who is absolutely Les Mis. Sorry.
They shouldn't be so similar if they don't want me to mix them up.
My entire, like, joke in all the marketing jokes, because I wasn't smart enough to think of Tale of Two Cuties, all of my jokes were how it's really just Les Mis, but not a musical. Okay, so first character is Jarvis Lorry. He's the one that's the crabby old bank manager. He's the... Who's that other Dickens character that he's like?
Who knows?
From the Christmas one.
Yeah, he shows up. The Scrooge.
Thank you. He's the Scrooge of
Mixed
this
Scrooge.
One. He's the Scrooge of this book, particular book.
Nice. Yeah.
Okay, I did it.
Well, naturally, I can't mix business with personal life, but
yeah,
I've done quite well without having a personal life.
Yeah, he's
that's
that
his whole thing.
Yeah, that's his whole jam.
Our first story tonight, everyone, is titled "A Festivus Wish." Christmas Eve, Paris, 1792. Snow was quickly falling as Jarvis Lorry tried to shake his melancholy before bed. Jarvis Lorry had always had everything he needed, a job, warm shelter, dear friends, but he still felt incomplete. All he longed for was the warmth of a lover who cared, who noticed him, who gave him the business like no one else. And so the tired, sad old man embraced himself in a lacy nightshirt and matching hat, curling up for yet another Christmas alone. The old man had just dozed off to French revolutionaries yelling out Joyeux Noël and Sacre Bleu and the traditional Le Pamplemousse when suddenly there was a knock at the door. A whiny but familiar voice cried out, Jarvis, you gotta let me in, man. The old man hurried to the door. As the nasally voice and knocking continued, Jarvis adjusted his nightcap as he opened the door to see a man with wild brown hair and a bewildered look in his eye. Jarvis's assistant, Jerry Seinfeld Cruncher, marched inside. Jarvis, there's no time like the present. Now I want to fuck you right now, Jerry loudly proclaimed to the old man. Jarvis was taken aback. He'd been single literally forever and gave no attention to anyone in that way. And didn't Jerry have a wife and family? Now I know I have a wife and family, Jerry said, responding to Jarvis's thought. But don't worry about that. I'm here and they're not. Okay, Jarvis said, trying to process this sudden exchange. Despite never giving anyone any kind of flirtatious or kinky attention, he'd always had a teensy crush on his assistant. That mullet-like brown hair, his mouth slightly gaping open at all times. But again, he'd never shown it.
But Jerry, Jarvis said, how did you know that I'm...
Jarvis, we all know you're gay! Like, really, really gay, Jerry Seinfeld Cruncher said. Literally everyone knows! Lucy knows! Her dad knows! Her weird husband knows! The entire barrister court of England knows! And Jerry and Jarvis, I'm so into it!
I never even knew you thought of me that way, Jarvis exclaimed.
What do you mean? What do you mean I never thought of you that way? Jerry Seinfeld Cruncher yelped dramatically, throwing his coat open, a shirt ruffle fluttering ever so slightly. That's the only way I think of you, my sweet kinky old man who's good with numbers and loves a good spanking.
Spanking? Jarvis whispered, turning red.
Spanking was only one of his favorite fantasies. Flustered, the old man paced back and forth. Did seriously everyone know he was gay? And how do they know he was into spanking? Did it matter when the bourgeoisie were about to be beheaded? No, it did not. Jarvis turned around to once more look upon his beloved assistant.
Now, why didn't you say anything before?
Because my voice sounds like this when I'm excited! Jerry Seinfeld Cruncher yelped out. And also, I've been taken to the I'm being taken to the guillotine tomorrow, so I figured this is my only chance to woo you. And with a dramatic turn, the men grabbed each other and started passionately tonguing like teenagers. Jerry was so excited that his arms got stuck in his coat, and Jarvis broke away from the kiss to help his assistant become untangled from his outerwear. The coat finally came off, and there he was, standing before Jarvis, backlit by the Yule log fire, Jerry Seinfeld Cruncher, wearing a tight black leather pants and a very, very, very puffy ruffled shirt. Upon seeing Jerry in the puffy shirt, Jarvis's penis arose with a hearty boing. The sweet nectar of life beating at the tip. Jarvis nervously approached Jerry, who gently grabbed his hand and placed it on his own throbbing knob. Jarvis had never seen anything like Jerry's penis before. It was the best of dicks. But also it was the worst of dicks. It was the cock of wisdom. It was the cock of foolishness. It was the penis of belief. It was the penis of incredulity. It was the wiener of light. It was the wiener of darkness. It was the boner of hope. It was the boner of despair. Jarvis had everything before him. He had nothing before him. Their balls were all going directly to heaven. Their balls were all going directly the other way. In short, Jerry Seinfeld Cruncher had the most mediocre, mind-numbingly boring man snake in the history of the planet. But no matter. This was, at last, Jarvis Lorry's moment. And Jarvis Lorry was going to use his moment to finally get fucking laid. Jerry started undressing as Jarvis reached for a crock of French butter to massage onto Jerry's flesh baguette. The butter melted into the shirt ruffles as Jarvis stopped Jerry's hands from unbuttoning the shirt.
Leave it on, he whispered. I've always wanted to be fucked by a fancy pirate.
Fine by me, said Jerry loudly. I've always wanted to be a fancy pirate. He carefully mounted Jarvis, hands upon the old man's aged love handles. After all, I sure do love me some booty. And so the thrusting began. Their round, pasty butts glistened with sweat, thrusting and jiggling in time with Carol of the Bells, the ass cheeks smacked and clapped in harmony with their holiday symphony. Bum, bum, I guess. Their dimpled pastel hips bucked and bowed like mechanical reindeer creaking their way to glory. Jarvis was being fucked so well that he lost his balance and nearly fell over. Jiminy, Jarvis cried out. Jiminy, Jarvis cried out in pleasure and surprise. It's Jerry, said Jerry Seinfeld Cruncher. And then he rolled his eyes. The thrusting intensified as the carolers and bell ringers faded away into the night. Jarvis's old man howls echoed in the halls. Jerry's nasally groans rattled the shelves. The puffy shirt became soaked with sweat, clinging to Jerry's oddly tiny nipples and clinging to Jarvis's ass crack, his old man ass crack. The ruffles bounced rhythmically as the two men humped and fucked frenetically in front of the crackling Yule log. Somehow, Jarvis's nightcap did not fall off. The clock struck midnight. Jarvis proclaimed, ejaculating into the fire, causing sparks to leap into the air. Jerry moaned, spraying his hopes and dreams into Jarvis's ass. The puffy shirt was now deflated. Jarvis sank his head into a limp ruffle on Jerry's chest as the two men awkwardly cuddled in front of the fire. Well, that was something, Jerry said politely. What a wonderful Christmas surprise, said Jarvis, fondling the pom-pom on his nightcap. He nuzzled into the deflated sleeve puffs as angry voices outside drew closer. Jerry let out a frustrated, ugh. What's the deal with the French Revolution anyway? He said in his whiny, nasally voice. Being French and poor isn't revolutionary. Suddenly, the front door burst open and a dozen angry civilians charged into the room, hoisting up Jerry and handcuffing him. Jarvis didn't even have time to cry out to his lover. Thanks for the fun, Jarvis. So long, you old so-and-so. Jerry Seinfeld Cruncher cried out as he was carried away by the revolutionaries disappearing into the night to his untimely demise. It stopped snowing, and Jarvis went to bed, listening to the carolers quietly sing Joy to the World, knowing life would never be the same again. The end.
That was Jarvis Laurie, as written by Lily Miller.
Lily. She's coming up on her last show and then she's moving.
Yeah.
The worst. She's
been talking about it for a long time.
I know. Hey, the Marquis Saint Evremond, who is Charles's uncle. I think he represents like the old school money, like the old like aristocracy that everyone else is really angry at.
Yeah.
That's my understanding of who that guy is. He's Charles Darnay's uncle.
Ugh, worst.
Yeah, the worst.
Our next story, children, is titled Marky Me, I'm Trash. It wasn't the best of butts or the worst of butts. The Marquis Saint Evremond thought, looking at himself in the mirror. It was beaten, bruised, and busted. But it just wasn't exciting. Just as he loved to consume duck eggs for breakfast and peacock at lunch and braised boar for dinner, he also liked variety in his bottoms. Who wants to eat the same ass every day? He dismissed his manservant with a wave of his lace handkerchief and began to relace his velvet breeches over the ass of wisdom, the ass of foolishness. Wise because it knew what it wanted. Foolish because it never seemed to know how to get it. His manservants could beat it like an egg. They could bite it like a tough roast of mutton. They could skewer it like a trader's head on a pike. They could plow it like a stubborn bit of peasant land fit only to grow ass potatoes. But they could never show it the cruelty that the Marquis Saint Evremond truly craved. With his breeches half-laced, the Marquis reflected on the royal curve of his love truncheon. It pulled delicately to the right like a noble and conservative penis should do. Yet it refused to rise to more than half-mast, even when a coaxed, lovely, red-headed stable boy hummed God Save the Queen whilst he sucked like the hungriest piglet. It's these damned humanitarians ruining my fun, the Marquis exclaimed, flogging his half-chub with one manicured hand, insisting on nonsense such as basic human rights and not dying of starvation. Always whining that they cannot pay their taxes because, well, their parents are dead and they're only 4 years old. Rubbish! Providing nothing but dead weight to job creators like myself. His scorn and class hatred got him throbbing just a little. His quarterstaff wasn't quite a quarter pounder, but it had started to drip a little cheese when the thought of widows and orphans came to his brain. Determined to have at least one miserable orgasm, the Marquis flogged harder. He thought about that time he had crushed a child beneath the wheels of his reckless carriage, killing the little street urchin instantly. Better to be dead than poor, he growled at his abused penis. His foreskin was rashy with friction. His urethra was as pink as the skin on a roasted piglet. I merely did them a favor. What's this? A sultry French voice spoke from the doorway. Do I hear the sound of a dry croissant in need of my special truffle butter? Shocked, the Marquis turned, his face a perfect O of surprise. Sir, I demand you leave at once. I do not respond to demands, you uncultured English cum dumpster, said the man, now strolling into the Marquis's pink and frilly bedroom. I only respond to one word, daddy. The Marquis blushed and tried to put away his chewed up shrimp, cocktail looking prick. How dare you? Who are you? The Frenchman smirked as he watched the Marquis's petite pie tucked back into their pod. I have come from Lacoste to have a good time. The Marquis gasped as he saw the arms of Lacoste upon the man's blouse, an embroidered alligator over the left breast. Then you are... Mais oui, smirked the French nobleman. Je suis Donatien Alphonse François de Marquis de Sade. The Marquis Saint Evremond stood with his mouth open, amazed. The Marquis de Sade wasted no time. He shoved the other Marquis to his knees and began to undo his own velvety wiener vent. I heard you the other day lecturing the terrible Beurre d'Arnay about pity. What was it you said? De Sade had pulled out his prodigious pork popsicle. Evremond licked his lips. I said that pity is a diseased variety of sentimentality. I asked him if he pities the swine whose flesh we eat. C'est moi! De Sade crammed his bacon buster into Evremond's mouth. I am the swine whose flesh you consume. You are the pig who eats his own kind, aren't you? Aren't you, my little piggy? Evremond snorted in shock, struggling to breathe around such a mouthful of sausage. Then he realized that his fight for breath was doing two things. It was making the other Marquis twitch and harden in his mouth, and it made him sound like the pig that he was. He snorted again. Oink, 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 went the Marquis Saint Evremond like the pig that he was, living off the slops of largesse and the sweat of the peasantry. Oink, 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 oink. The Sade fucked Evremond's face as mercilessly as Evremond fucked his tenants when rent was due. That's right, my British pig, suck my French cock like you've never tasted brie before. Suck it like I come champagne. And you desperately want to forget what a parasite you are. Evermond was overwhelmed. He had never been treated this way before. He had only been dominated by men that he owned. This was a new experience entirely. Suddenly, his own little Smokey was harder than it had been in years, poking importantly out of his breeches, demanding attention. Sod pulled out of Evermond's mouth with a loud pop. "Please, monsieur," Evermond began. But the Sod swiftly slapped the Englishman across his porcine face. "I am noble, I am no mere monsieur. You may call me by my title, which you will never correctly pronounce, sir. You may call me Daddy. Do you understand me, pig?"
Yes, Daddy," said Evermond at once, clear pre-cum dripping from his miniature Ebenezer splooge.
Très bien. Next, do not ask me for anything. This is about moi. This is not about you. I shall use you as I see fit. I shall drop you like the moment that you cease to please me. That is my way. Perhaps one day they shall name this method of lovemaking after moi. De sadism. Oui, oui. I like the sound of that.
Evermond was about to say that he also hoped that gleeful submission and pain sluttery should be named for himself. Evremondism, maybe? But just as he was about to speak again, the Sod shut him up.
"Show Daddy how the piggies eat!" Evermond opened his mouth, and the Sod stuffed it with a wad of francs.
He tucked 1 pound coins into Evermond's tiny, rosy urethra, sounding him with good sound cash. Next, he wrapped his own mythic cock in deeds and contracts he picked up from Evermond's desk, seeing rental agreements and tax forms and letters of indenture. He curled these around his Gallic goo gun, forming a crude paper condom. He found Evermond's puckered English channel stubborn, but accommodating. Evermond moaned out of his mouthful of money.
"Take it," the Sod growled in his ear. "Take it all, you, take it, you little, take it. Take your title, take your lands, take your privilege and the rank and noble birth, and literally shove them up your ass. That's a good piggy. That's a daddy's piglet."
Evermond came in seconds, gentrifying his carpet with some ruling class semen. Screaming somewhere behind hundreds of French francs, the Sod pulled his French franc out of Evermond's lower London, pulled the papers off, and turned Evermond around to ejaculate straight into one of the Marquis's British blue eyes.
"That was so hot," Evermond said, though his
eyes were watering.
"That was like some great marquee on marquee action." "Your deeds are covered in your shit, pig,"
the Sod glided from the room, pants around his ankles, never to return. The end.
And that was The Marquis, as written by Meg Ellison. That's how they say it in England.
It is. Madame Defarge is my favorite because she's like the she's the antagonist, but she's like the she's this like bloodthirsty, like angry. She's great. I'm trying to remember why I like her so much, but I feel like she's like the. Man, all I can do is compare it to Les Mis. I'm trying not to so hard.
Does she run a hotel?
Well, that's what I was going to say. She's kind of like that, but like the antagonist and doesn't have a hotel.
A Tale of Two Titties.
All right. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was also the Kanye West of times. And she had two good titties. A true lady of the night, because she really only looked good at night in the darkness and shadows that matched her cold, dark heart. But of course, that doesn't make our leading lady immune to getting hot and heavy with a much younger man. who she had wrapped around her very large hands and her very sharp knitting needles. And in the night, I hear him talk, the coldest story ever told. Somewhere far along this road, he lost his soul to a woman so heartless named Madame Defarge. Long before Kim, way, way, way before George W. and Tay Swift, Kanye spent a gap year in Paris, sans Jay-Z, learning from and falling for an indomitable Madame Defarge. Kanye arrived at the shop just in time to hear the last bit of arguing between Ed and T. The last thing he heard her yell at her husband was, "Oh, how refreshing," coming from the guy who wanted to name the shop Wine'em Dine'em 69'em. Then he saw Ed storm off to visit whoever the fuck. And Kanye snuck in through the back. His favorite way to get into most places. He snuck up behind the stout apple of his eye, admiring her handiwork from afar, but also those titties. Can't miss them titties. She was hard at work, which in turn was making him very hard at work. He came up behind her and whispered in her ear, "Let's get lost tonight. You could be my black Kate Moss tonight." Madame Defarge was like, "Kanye, I really want to come kick it with you. You're my American boy. But I don't have time to take you and your bougie friends out again tonight. I have like 50 more names to knit before tonight. Then I gotta be out by the guillotine all day. I'm just like hella busy and really overwhelmed this week. Plus, don't you have work tomorrow?" Kanye. It says pause for dramatic effect. Because Kanye is all about dramatic effect. "Before you ask me to go get a job today, can I at least get a raise on a minimum wage?" Madame Defarge was like, "You're right, you're right, you're so right. That's what we're fighting for, equality. Well, most socioeconomic equality with no mention of race so far, which obviously big mistake, but whatever. It's a bunch of straight French dudes who don't have any of their shit together. Anyways, stupid capitalist pigs with their ridiculous idea of an invisible hand. Hope they enjoy their invisible hand jobs at the guillotine." Then Kanye responds, "I say fuck the police, that's how I treat them. We buy our way out of jail, but we can't buy freedom. We'll buy a lot of clothes, but we don't really need them. Things we buy to cover up what's inside, because they make us hate ourselves and love they wealth." She put a swollen, overworked finger up to his lips to quiet him, and they exchanged a deep, passionate kiss as she grabbed his face with her calloused hands. Madame Defarge says, "Nobody gets me like you, Kanye. How are we both so freaking woke, yet so despised by everyone around us? What the fuck is up with that, Kanye? Since hating the same things as your sexual partner is literally the most powerful aphrodisiac of all time," Madame Defarge suddenly became incredibly aroused by her American boy. The powerful mix of mutual hatred for the aristocracy and pure sexual lust became so overwhelming that she threw him onto her knitting chair, hiked up her skirt, and sat on his perfect, slightly larger than average embodiment of the principles of the revolution. Madame Defarge said, "Now I'm gonna sit on your face and I want you to toss my big Greek salad, then liberate my tight French pousse." She pronounces it pousse because she's French, like duh. "You're gonna do it like you're a general in a European war or manager at some weird fusion restaurant, but sexier, Kanye, sexier. Drop it to the floor, make that ass shake, whoa, make the ground move, that's an ass quake, build a house up on that ass, that's an ass state. Kanye, I want you to oppress your literal dick into my literal vagina. Not use your ridiculous standard of beauty to make me feel bad about my body. I want you to talk dirty about people we hate and capitalism, not what my ass looks like, you weirdo. Why are men all so disgusting? All I ever wanted from you was to talk dirty to me about breaking political and cultural norms and institutions and indulge my sexual revenge fantasy through role play and hate fucking my brains out. with some casual and consensual choking, Kanye.
But no, you just had to take it there. I'm done, Kanye. Sorry, not sorry. Kanye just sat there and was like, you run and tell your friends that you're leaving me. They say they don't see what you see in me. You wait a couple months, then you're gone, see. You'll never find nobody better than me. Just fucking go, Madame Lafarge says. Like, for reals, get the fuck out of here. Kanye, as he's walking out the door, starts singing, she take my money when I'm in need. Yeah, she's a trifling friend indeed. Oh, she a gold digger way over town that digs on me. Oh, that's a low blow, Kanye, even for you. You know I don't even like the other kind of pearl necklace because that's how much I hate excessive luxury. And just like that, he left Saint Antoine forever. But as we all know, what he did keep was his love for Paris, a basic. His love of ass and titties, also basic. And his disgust for social injustice and white people in power, which is pretty awesome, right, y'all? The end.
And that was Madame Defarge, as written by Moon Cho.
Moon. I love Moon Cho so much. Go, if she's ever doing anything, go see her. She's so funny and so nice.
I agree. I concur with this opinion.
She's just a goddamn delight. I really should have gotten the rest of the characters loaded while you were doing that, huh?
Well, it only took me a second.
I know, you're right. Sidney Carton. Oh, yeah, he's the young lawyer who is actually in Evermond, but changes his name. Oh, no, sorry, I'm thinking of Darnay. Oh, yeah, that's right. He's the guy that starts off as an alcoholic and then becomes, like, one of the heroes. Nice. So he has, like, a whole arc. It's a whole thing.
Look, he has a whole story.
He has a whole... It's a whole thing. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
You have to come with us, Cart. And why is that? I asked Lucy as I sorted through the evidence files for the Defarge case. I had her on speaker because juggling phone and files was likely to spill the contents of set files onto the floor, probably into a puddle of soy sauce from lunch. Because I'm not taking no for an answer, she said, her voice dropping into Dom range. I swallowed hard. I've got so much to do, Luce, I said, but I knew she heard the lack of conviction in my tone even before Rye chuckled from the doorway. You, Sidney Carton, are so fucked, he said. She always gets what she wants. He sauntered across my office until he stood beside me, a bit closer than a colleague, or even a friend, might, but anyone who saw us would think it was because we'd known each other since law school, you know, one of those things. At least they would if they didn't notice Rye's hand caressing my lower back or his lips against my temple or the way I shivered in response. He pressed closer, but I held back from touching the body that had belonged to Lucy since he'd started wearing her thin leather collar 2 months ago. Though we all played together and Rye and I continued fucking, he and Lucy had begun exploring levels of kink beyond my comfort zone. I'd become more a part of their audience at parties than a participant in scenes, and I missed him more than I said since their thing was new and I was giving them space to figure it out. CJ Stryver, Lucy's voice was all Dom now, and Rye shuddered against me. Make sure Cart comes. Yes, ma'am, he said, eyes closing. Good boy, and hung up. I waited until Rye could look at me again and smirked. The Dickens Fair? Really? You two really want me to go to the fucking Dickens Fair? Trust me, he said. It'll be worth it. He glanced at my door. I did promise Luce. He put his hand on my belt, and I wanted nothing more than to see him on his knees keeping that promise. I'm due in court, I said. Please... Rye's pleading went straight to my cock. She's gonna be upset with me. I wanna see that. I sighed as Rye leaned in and whispered, kinky bastard. As he played with my belt, I sighed, ugh, okay, fine, I'll go to the fucking fair. Rye laughed. You're so easy, he said over his shoulder as he walked out the door. And you're a dick, I said. And you like that, he said. Very much, I said, just not before court. It was 1:30 when my Lyft driver left me at the Cow Palace in the midst of women in hoop skirts and men in top hats and tails. I handed my ticket to a man dressed like a Mary Poppins chimney sweep. And I tried really hard to not roll my eyes when he greeted me in a fake Cockney accent. Good day, governor. Here's a map and list of the day's activities. I hope you have yourself a real good time, I do. I wanted to puke. As I stepped into the dim interior, I texted Lucy, where are you? ? Then scanned the crowd. Though most people wore elaborate Victorian costumes, there were a few like me, dressed in jeans and sneakers. You are late, came Lucy's reply. This is fucking weird, I texted back. Mad Sal's, now, all caps. Making my way to the other end of the hall, I was mesmerized in spite of myself by the men in gorgeous waistcoats tied tight over slim hips, long legs, sheathed in fitted trousers, gloved hands clutching silver-topped walking sticks. Gloves were something of a fetish for me. Rye had amazingly beautiful hands. They were what first attracted me to him, and I loved when he wore his black leather gloves, which explains the groan that left my mouth as I stepped into the music hall and saw him and Lucy standing in the dark in the back corner. They were in costume. Lucy in a black lace corset with a blood red skirt, Rye in a gold brocade waistcoat with a knee-length great coat, clutching a lion-headed walking stick in his gloved hands. His grin was all the evidence I needed that the bastard had worn them for me. We greeted each other with quick, friendly hugs, though. As we settled next to each other, I rested my hand on top of Rye, stroking the soft leather with my thumb. It was between acts, the seats nearly empty, while the stage was being set for a dramatization of the trial scene from A Tale of Two Cities. Okay, so why are we here? I asked. Wait, Lucy said, then raised her chin as a man stepped onto the stage. His back was to us, but his costume, a long blue coat with dark velvet collar, was magnificent. When he adjusted the collar with his gloved hands, I cursed, and Lucy chuckled. The man on the stage lifted his head to look in a mirror suspended above him. A bar of light fell across his face, illuminating it, as he pushed the hair off his forehead. The likeness was so exact. The man could have been my twin. I gasped, and he caught my gaze in the mirror and held it. Yes, Lucy said. She turned abruptly, laid her arms around my neck. Rye moved closer, leaned into me as his hand rose towards the tab of my jeans. Yes? He asked. The man on stage still stared at me with features so like my own, I felt my cheeks flush. Yes, 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 I breathed. God, yes. Rye's hand undid my jeans, enough to slip inside and take hold of my cock. The smooth leather cool against my skin. He stroked upwards, fingers closing around the head. Shit, I whispered, closing my eyes. Eyes open, Lucy commanded. Watch him. In our dark corner, Lucy and Rye's bodies shielded me from view, but I held the gaze of the man on stage as Rye began to work my cock with long downward strokes, a wicked twist as his fingers traveled my length, his thumb grazing the tip, and always the feel of leather against my skin. The man on the stage licked his lips, and I mirrored him. Do you think his cock looks like yours? Rye whispered. Would it feel like yours in my hand? I moaned. Words cart, Lucy said, and Rye's hand tightened, then stilled. Leather-clad fingers teasing lower, stroking my balls. The affirmative hissed from my mouth. Imagine how you would feel inside you, Rye said, fucking yourself on that cock, staring into that face as you come. Do you want to come? Lucy asked. Please. Rye's hand stroked faster. Lucy leaned closer. Okay, please, please, I begged again.
and bit my lower lip, my legs trembling. "We love you, Cart," Rye whispered. "Come for us, Cart," Lucy said. "Come right fucking now." I thrust against Rye's hand once, twice, and I was gone. The world graying out, so I only knew Rye's hand, my cock, and the eyes of the man on the stage. When I could breathe again, I stroked Rye's hand, then looked at Lucy and said, "We are so coming back." The end.
That was Sydney Carton, is written by Diane Glasman.
Okay, so now is Charles Darnay, who's the guy that looks like Sidney Carton but is not. He's the young French noble that's actually part of the Evremont family. But he's, like, disgusted by his family and their money, so he takes his mother's maiden name, which is Darnay, and leaves France for England. So, yeah. He also has an arc where he's a really good guy, and he goes back to France and risks getting arrested, and then has to try the whole thing.
Nice. Go Darnay.
It's all very complicated.
They should be the, do you think that the Thor brothers would play them?
Yes.
Okay.
Charles Darnay looked lovingly at his perfect wife, Lucy, as she lay asleep in bed dreaming. He supposed she dreamt of her children, and perhaps even of himself. From the dark and shadowed place where he sat, his heart heavy with the choice before him, Charles Darnay allowed himself a momentary dream as well. He pictured himself on a shoreline in England, where, on a clear day, he could see his homeland of France, and all around him, he could feel on the wind a song of peace. The great clock in on the mantel chimed the first hour of the new day and roused Charles Darnay from his waking dream. He was himself again, a man torn in between the promises of his past and the responsibilities of his future. There was no shining shore, only the darkness of the bleak hour, as the heavy weight of duty upon his shoulders pressed more. He turned away from his sleeping wife and walked to the hall to put a distance between him and the shame he felt in choosing to deceive her. For hadn't the choice already been made? What was the brooding? Oh, what was he brooding over if it wasn't the way to do it and not the act itself? In the darkness of the hall, Charles Darnay felt the truth of it grasp his heart and wring it free of indecision. There was no other way but to go to France. Charles Darnay lifted his head, glad that this moment of truth had come to him at last, and saw that he was facing the hallway mirror. The glass, like the shimmering water from the shore of his dreams, glinted in the light of the moon, and though darkly he could see just the reflection of a man who seemed like himself, but also apart from himself, before he could think what he was doing, Charles Darnay reached out to that man, who, being his own reflection, reached out back to him. "Of course," Charles Darnay said quietly to the reflection, "it is only myself." But that only seemed wrong. The Charles Darnay in the mirror was a man of decision and grace and fortitude and bravery, and even in the dark hours of the night when no one could care, he was a handsome man. His hair was well kept and tied neatly, but not in like a showy way. It was tied with a little ribbon at the base of his neck. Charles Darnay reached back to that ribbon and now pulled at it, releasing his thick, flowy chestnut hair to dance around his shoulders and at his chin. "And even now, like this, you look like a man who has done exactly what is right," said the reflection to Charles Darnay, who could not help but step closer to the mirror. It was then Charles Darnay thought of the trial all those many years ago when he could have been hanged for a spy. There had been a mirror there too, built to reflect light down onto him so that he may be seen by the greater assembly. He had seen himself in that mirror as well. The years between had not changed him. If anything, happiness and familial responsibility had given an even greater dignity in his bearing. Back then, there had been those who thought they could see a reflection of him, Charles Darnay, in Sidney Carton. It was that similarity that had saved his life, but it was not a true reflection. Sidney Carton would drink and waste his life away,
But not you, Charles Darnay's reflection said in the darkness. Not I. So close was Charles Darnay to the mirror that his hot breath would momentarily cloud the vision of himself like a veil between a shy bride and her bridegroom. Don't hide yourself from me, he said to his reflection. Never, never hide yourself from me. Charles Darnay's fingers touched the vapored glass just under his reflection's eye and traced the shape of his perfect cheekbones to a strong, masculine jawline and down his strong and stately throat just to the fold of his dressing gown. With his other hand, he opened the dressing gown, showing his reflection the chest that kept within its protective cage the heart of a truly righteous man. Charles Darnay's pulse quickened as the robe fell further and further from his body until it pooled around the feet of the reflection. No one will ever know the sacrifices you have made, the reflection said to Charles Darnay. No, no one but myself. Charles Darnay watched in the reflection as his cock seemed to want to reach out to, in the darkness, towards that other self, the two perfect moonlit cocks moving towards each other with the same steely resolve Charles Darnay felt in his heart to move towards France. He could not but reach down and stroke the honest cock, for its thriving, its soft, creamy skin hiding within it a fortitude that felt strong enough to bear the weight of the crimes of Charles Darnay's ancestors. You are doing the only thing a man who considers himself good could do, the reflection said, soothing any remaining doubts left in Charles Darnay's mind. You are the only good man left in the entire world. Yes, Charles Darnay said, into the night, into the dark glass, and into the heart of his reflection. You will save Gabelle from his imprisonment, said the reflection. Yes, said Charles Darnay, his hand beginning to find rhythm as it worked the organ of his goodly deeds from stern to stern. You will save France from the bloodbath of the revolution by this act, said the reflection. Yes, oh yes, whispered Charles Darnay, watching the two cocks side by side being rewarded well and good for the great works they had done and had yet to do. There has never been so good a man, the reflection said, with full force as delicious tension built in Charles Darnay's body. Now reach down, and play with your balls. Yes! Charles Darnay reached down and delicately played with his balls as he thought about what a good, good and honorable man he was and had been with every breath he had ever taken. And as he stroked and teased his own great manhood, he thought with great humility about how all his wealth and power had been given to him on the backs of the oppressed and handed down to him by cruel and unkind men. You will right those wrongs, cried the reflection in glorious agony. Yes, I will. Charles Darnay's answering call. Oh, God, yeah. He and the reflection cried together as both released in powerful fountainous streams the white and frothy foundations of life. The air around Charles Darnay chilled into resolve as he caught his breath and the passion of the moment quieted and he could hear the ticking of the mantel clock once more. He put his robe back on and looked one last time at his reflection before he headed to his study to write a letter to his wife explaining his motives for leaving her to go to France. The end.
That was Charles Darnay, as written by Claire Rice.
And she won.
The hilarious Claire Rice.
God, she's so goddamn funny. Anyway, Miss Pross is the last one. She's Lucy. Lucy is the fair-haired, beautiful protagonist that everyone wants to bone. Anyway, that's her governess or her protector, her nanny, her whatever the fuck women used to have to make sure they didn't get stuck up trees.
Our last story is titled Miss Pross's Day Out. Miss Pross was out in town for the day on a mission. She'd cycled through all the dishes she knew how to prepare, English and French, and she was determined to find a new one for her ladybird before the day's end. Taking the streets at an industrious clip, Miss Pross listed out the dishes she knew in her head. She was so lost in thought that she slammed into a very square and solid gentleman on the corner in front of her. A pair of firm hands covered in silver rings caught her as she lost her balance, setting her to rights with a gentle touch. I know, it smells incredible. I'd be in a rush too. An American? Miss Pross eyed the man in front of her. He was dressed garishly in a dark dress shirt designed to emulate flames, flickering up and down the edges and sleeves. The spectacles on his face were of a foreign shape and design, with the lenses darkened in such a way that Miss Pross could not see the eyes behind them. Shocks of bright yellow hair stood from the top of his head at sharp attention. It was as if he had been struck by the wrath of God Almighty and never fully recovered. The man wore enough rings, bracelets, and necklaces to be a man of means, but his position next to an open fire on the street made it much more likely that he was a gentleman of ill repute. And what are you doing? Asked Miss Pross, clutching her shawl to her chest, unsure whether to extricate herself from the closeness of their encounter or to push him out of the way so that she could discover what he was cooking. Well, ma'am, the man said, pointing to the small circles of juicy meat that were sizzling pleasantly on a pan held over the fire, I'm getting ready to take a nice little trip to a place I like to call Flavortown. Flavortown? Miss Pross had never heard of such a place, and she couldn't possibly see how this man planned on getting there using meat circles. Yes, ma'am, I'm Guy Fieri, and this is Pubs, Taverns, and Street Fairs. You're more than welcome to join me, but I gotta warn you, it could get a little funkalicious. He tipped the spectacles down to the end of his nose and grinned at Miss Pross roughishly. She felt her pulse quicken and heat creep up the back of her neck. Holy burgers, Batman, we got fire in Flavortown. The man leapt for the pan and expertly flipped the meat circles over, one of which appeared to be smoking rather intensely. What did you call those? Asked Miss Pross, stepping closer to the fire and to the man. She couldn't look away from his face. She noticed now that the same crisp blonde hair that struck out from his head at all angles also covered his chin in a tight pattern that she'd never seen before. Those are burgers, he said. All American cheeseburgers that are so good they're out of bounds. Squaring her shoulders and lifting her chin, Miss Pross pulled every part of her resolve to one place and asked, will you teach me? Oh yeah, he said, clapping his hands together and rubbing them back and forth. This is gonna be so money. The man turned over a crate and set a plate on it, as if he were dining there on the street. He sliced bread and then lay the bread open on the plate. Watching him work, Miss Pross imagined him laying something else open on that plate. She began to tremble, the sudden need to push this strange American into the nearest alley and throw herself upon him was overwhelming in spite of the fact that she was supposed to be learning a new dish for her ladybird. First, you'll need to stack your veggies, Guy said, gesturing at slices of tomato laid next to the bread. Go ahead, as much or as little as you want. She wanted to so much. Before he could give her the next step in making a burger, Miss Pross felt a great fluttering in her entire body, and she reached up and brushed a trembling hand across the tips of his hair. It felt exactly like the bristles of a broom. And Miss Pross was shocked and thrilled at the strangeness of the sensation. She immediately wanted to know what those bristles would feel like between her legs. This jewelry, his jewelry clanged and jangled, his hands gripping her waist and pulling her into him.
Shut the front door. You shut the front door, he murmured.
Murmured against her eager mouth before kissing her with the type of hunger usually reserved for the burgers. He smelled greasy and like a male, but in a tasty way. He pulled her hips tighter against him where his stiff cock pressed into her. The heat in her stomach, the fire in her limbs, it was revolutionary. Maybe the French were onto something. Miss Pross paused, breathless. She pulled away and with all her considerable strength, hauled Guy Fieri into the nearby alley, slamming him against the brick wall. It was her special move. Hands poised at the waist of his pants, Miss Pross asked, is this okay?
Oh yeah! This is gangsta!
Miss Pross had no idea what the fuck that meant. But judging from the way his dick sprang forth upon release, it must have been a good thing. Dinner was still undecided for her ladybird, but Miss Pross was having sausage tonight. She took his American meat into her mouth, sucking deeply, her capable hands kneading the strange man's ass with the same ferocity she usually reserved for fresh dough to make bread for her ladybird.
Oh yeah, this is money,
groaned the man, urged on by his strange Americanisms and the violent upheaval within her own knickers. Miss Pross bobbed her mouth faster and tighter on Guy's dick. She heard his jewelry clanging and jangling and knew a tap was coming, but not as fast as he was, because Miss Pross was a proper woman and a proud caretaker. She cupped the balls. She cupped the balls like a lady, took a breath, and opened her throat. Guy's cum spilled down her throat, a mess of flavors. Miss Pross stood and carefully gathered her shawl around herself. She rustled Guy's bristled hair one last time. Funkalicious, she said, before turning on her heel and walking back into the real world, where her original loyalties lay. As she left the alley and turned down the street towards the market, she passed two men who pointed at Guy's fire.
I say a cook on the street up ahead, Joe, said one. I say a chef on the corner before us, Tom, said the other.
Miss Pross nodded her head to them both as she passed. I've been recalled to Flavortown, gentlemen, she said out loud, wiping lightly at the corners of her little mouth. She'd have to pick a special broom on her way through the market to get the ingredients for burgers.
The end! Yay!
That was Miss Pross as written by Melanie Burke.
And that's it. That's our tale of two cities. Right?
So
was there anything else that we missed?
Tale of two cities. Come see us live.
Oh, your voice was Baruch Porras Hernandez, who is our resident reader. He is a hilarious man who does one-man shows and stand-up and all kinds of things all over the city. Go see him. Follow him on the socials.
Commission him to draw your wiener.
Commission him to draw dick. He does that somehow as a side gig, which I still sort of can't believe. And I think that started here, which I'm kind of pretty proud of.
Yeah.
So we have a book. It's called Loose Lips. It's stories from the first 3 years of the show. And he started drawing dicks in them when people bought them during the shows. Which, by the way, are on the first Thursday of every month. And it just became a thing. And now he solicits through Instagram, posts them all there, and you can send him a dick pic, and he'll give you a lovely artistic rendering of it.
Yeah, or
a
veg.
He does veges, too. That's true.
He had to learn that one.
It took a little bit more practice, I think. But, you know, he cares and loves them just as much, which he has said to me multiple times while we looked into each other's eyes. There's a lot of eye contact with Shipwreck.
That's all we do.
That's all we do. Yeah, so we're here first Thursday of every month at the Booksmith in the Upper Haight, which is our de facto home base. Come see us live. It's $15 with an open bar. It's the best deal in town. You can also like us on Facebook to get info about upcoming shows. You can buy our book through booksmith.com and we'll sign it for you. And if you put a note in the comments field, we can get Baruch to draw a dick for you. That's the thing now, it turns out. We are surprised to learn.
Absolutely.
You got anything else? I don't think I got anything else.
That's it.
I think we did it.
I hope it's warm in the future when this is being heard. What is it, like May?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, because it's one a week.
Let's go with
starting.
May. Yeah.
It'll be May. Yeah.
Thereabouts.
Happy May.
Happy May, you guys.
I'm going to go out and do a little mountain biking.
I'm going to do some spring cleaning.
Cannot wait.
Spend the afternoon at the beach. That's what I'm going to do.
Of course.
Of course.
C'est vrai. That's our new audio tag.
You're
by
so
the way.
Cultured now. When did this happen? This is news to me.
On peut le français.
The real money is the friends we made along the way, essentially.
Yeah. Les amis.